Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Jacob Tender, and this is episode 18 of Variable Bitrate. When young music geeks like me get an inkling that the music industry might be the place for them, A&R is often the first place they decide they want to end up. Signing unheard-of bands and pushing them into popular music is the dream, right? The reality, though, is that those coveted label spots are often harder and harder to come by over the years. As the role of tastemaker has fallen to bloggers and fans, many A&R departments have been downsized and roles have changed. Frankly, I don't know what the role of a modern A&R is, so I'm glad to have Johnny Minardi here to discuss what it is he does and how his job has changed over the past 12 years. Johnny, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm excited to talk to you. Over the past couple days, I've been kind of stewing over a post that you made on Facebook, sort of, detailing your part in a major release back in, 2004? This is Panic of the Discos. I write Sins, Not Tragedies.
Yep. 2005, actually. That was 2005. So I think it was September 2005, October. Yeah, September 2005.
Right. So
11 years ago, like 2 weeks ago.
And so, for those that aren't friends with you on Facebook, what was this story all about? You were pretty young at this point,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I was, 22 at that point? Yeah, I moved down to Fuel Bar Ramen at 21, and I started at the retail position at the company, not an A&R. And for the first year, I was just the retail guy. I had experience from a record store. I had my own label prior. So being friendly with the label got me into the position where he's like, I'm expanding, come down, do retail. I was like, I've never done that, but I kind of understand what I'm supposed to be doing. So just teach me. That's cool. Let's do that. So we'd put out probably six, seven records, something like that before the Panic one. So I kind of had my feet wet, a little bit understanding. But that record, obviously, looking back on it, depending on how old everyone is that's listening, was an insane release for the label at the time, for a band that size at the time. Like nothing, we had never seen anything like it during the rollout of the record, during pre-orders and all that different stuff. So when that came out, it was basically, just to summarize the post in a sense, was it came out and my boss at the time, who was running Fuel Bar Ramen, was on his honeymoon / wedding in Italy. So little to no contact, maybe a couple emails, maybe a phone call once every couple days. And he left like 5 days before the record came out. So I was finishing setting it up for him with the team at Fuel Bar Ramen, which again, we were all very young at the time. It was all like early 20s, mid 20s, not a ton of experience because the label was just starting to explode. So we weren't this huge company. We weren't with Atlantic yet, but we were starting to get friendly with them and get some help from them. And that record, that day it came out, there was no, there was not a lot of digital. So everything was, people would still rush to stores to buy records. So when that happened, we woke up, I was in Tampa at the time, so it was East Coast time. But when that happened, 9, 10 a.m. or something, we were getting blown up by Best Buys, Circuit Cities, whatever it was at the time, and every chain was blowing through their stock like within an hour of doors opening, which had never happened. So that happened and everyone's freaking out like, you got to order more, you got to get more. And I was just like, I don't know how to do that in a sense. I don't know if I'm able to do that, but I was kind of in charge of that side of it for that week. And then it happened again in the Midwest when all those stores were opening and they were freaking out. And then again on the West Coast when those opened, and I was sitting there like freaking out because I'm about to green light orders that are going to cost the company $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 just with a flick of a button. And we didn't do that. We didn't spend that kind of money. I'm sure the record cost like $20,000 to make total, it was nothing at the time compared to what they became. And we used to press 5,000, 10,000 CDs. We weren't pressing 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 at the time for certain bands, especially baby bands or first record bands. They were, a crazy situation. But so that happened. I kind of called around. I called Atlantic. I called trusted friends. I think even other labels I might have left out of the post. I think I called like competing labels that I was friends with, and they were just like, what are you doing? Get off the phone and go order those. I was like, I don't know, man. Like, I feel like I'm gonna lose my job. Like, and it just was this thing. And I, eventually enough people gave me the right you know, info. And I think their management at the time was very much like, make the call now. We need these in the stores by Thursday or Friday, and you got to call it now to make that happen. So we did it. Everything worked out. It's obviously went out without a little – there was probably hiccups because we should have put more in stores, but Best Buys and everything were hesitant because there was no sales history. So we had to, like, you know, as much as we could beef up the number with them, there's only so much, because – I'm sure in the past we've done that and it didn't sell well. And they were like, well,
yeah,
you told us to order 10,000. We sold 1,000. What's the deal? This one was the reversal. So that was a wild day in Field Bar Ramen history, I guess. And the whole office was losing their minds. And our boss was in Italy getting married like that morning. So it was pretty, pretty intense.
So safe to say, FBR didn't expect that.
No.
From Panic at the Disco.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know what we were to expect. I mean, we always had lofty expectations, but we were also very realistic. And we were, you know, we were a very shoestring company still, where it was not spend a lot of money. We actually never became the company to spend a ton of money at the time. I was there 8 years, and I don't think we ever, like, overspent on records. We always were like, we would always have to talk producers down on their budgets, marketers down, video budgets, like everything. It was, that's why it ran so well, though, is because it was always very strategic. It was never just, oh, throw money at it and maybe it'll work. It just didn't work like that. We would do very similar start plans for every record, for every release, for every band. And if it started to go, you put more in. And if it didn't, you get creative and reevaluate and try something else. But you never threw like another 50 grand at something to be like, oh, we just need that one music video, that one this, that one that. It was never that. It was like, get strategic. Maybe it's okay, let's figure it out for the fall touring and let's build around that then, you know. So it was always a plan, and that's one thing I learned the most from my boss at the time. And I've been at other, when I was at Atlantic watching them do things, it was different. They were, okay, well, let's just throw more money at things. And I was like, oh my God, like the budgets that were released there were so different, and it was hard to get used to. And almost like, I didn't even like it. I didn't like being there with like almost open-ended budgets, because you just get lazy and you kind of lose that drive, that drive of like getting, being smart about it, I guess.
Right. That focus on, you know, what is the right next step, not just what is a next step.
Totally. And putting importance on certain things and not just like, oh, well, let's go get the big name producer. It's like, well, no, let's start at the bottom and like make the songs connect with fans and then go and, you know, do it that way. But yeah, I mean, there's a million ways to do it and no actual blueprint, I guess.
Earlier, you mentioned before going to FBR that you had your own label. This was Little League Records, started sometime around 2001 and ended right before you're going into Fueled by Ramen. So take me back to Chicago when you were starting this thing up.
Yes.
How did that come about? And, you know, let's talk about some of these amazing names that you kind of found for yourself. And I mean, you launched careers at that point, even so early. So let's go back.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you putting it that way. That's a fun way to look at it. Going a little bit further back from that, all I ever did as a kid was listen to music and tell friends about music. I'm sure it's a likely story for a lot of people. And before all that, I would just kind of be on street teams, and I was in a terrible nu metal phase, which I kind of loved because there was so much money being thrown at it at the time that I was on these street teams that I was receiving so much cool access to shows and samplers and, you know, just tons of new music all the time. So it kind of felt awesome. And I'd bring it to school, tell all my friends. It was just kind of a natural thing that I always wanted to find the band and bring it to my friends, and then we can go to the show together. You know, like that was the end all be all. I'd go to record stores, and we'd have my parents would drive me around to record shows, and just really silly stuff looking back. But it actually helped shape what I wanted to do. So then when I turned 18, I kind of decided, I was always like going to local shows with friends in high school, and I was seeing bands, and I was so naive that I would be like, how come this band isn't in Best Buy? How come this band doesn't have a CD pressed? Why are they burning CDs and selling those? I don't understand how this works, you know? And I would get friendlier, and I'd help them with merch, and I would carry their bins out, and I would, you know, just kind of be a part of their process and learn it. And then they were kind of, I one day was like, well, why don't you go to this producer and work with him and get your CD in Best Buy? And they're like, they would kind of laugh, you know, the bands that had experience. And I was like, I don't get it. Why don't we just do that? And they're like, well, what do you mean? And I'm like, let's just do that. Let's just figure out a way and do that. And they're like, all right, I like the ambition, but I don't understand what you're saying. I'm like, well, how about I come up with a little bit of money, I'll call the producer, I'll put you in the studio, and then when I have CDs, I'll go and call Best Buy. You know, it was like that simple to me. And they were just like, you're crazy. That's not how it works. I'm like, well, let's make it work that way. Whatever, you know? And the first band I remember I reached out to was a band I went to high school with called 504 Clan. And great band. And they, again, that was the conversation with them. And they were just like, sure, if you want to pay for our CD, you could press it. And, you know, we'll just do like a 50-50 handshake thing. And that's awesome. So we did it and it worked out great. And I didn't spend a ton of money on it. We sold a bunch locally. The band started touring. I mean, they were going out with like, they would take Fall Out Boy out actually. That's how much ahead of that they were. Yeah. So it's like around here in Chicago, they were like a thing that was working. So it was cool. So I kind of turned a little bit of a profit. And before that, actually, I had signed another band called August Premiere, like at the same time, I was doing the same thing with them. And August Premiere was actually done first, and they were a band that went on to Fuel by Ramen later and put out a record that didn't do so well there. I think they broke up pretty quickly after signing to Fuel by Ramen. But the story is that the drummer of August Premiere is the one that introduced Pete Wentz to John Janik at Fuel by Ramen, just because they would play shows together. So a few of the bands that I started working with, those two, 504 Clan and August Premiere. Then we did some other bands called After Project, Feeling Left Out. And then I met William Beckett, who was Remember Maine at the time, because the drummer of 504 Clan was like, yo, this kid at my school, you got to hear him. It's like Dashboard. And I was like, okay. And at the time, that's all anyone cared about in high school, you know?
Right.
So it was cool. So I met William and the record was just done. It was finished. We were recording two extra songs. He's like, can you put this out? And I was like, absolutely. Like, I'm not, and it actually took some convincing, actually, because I was kind of like, it sounds so much like Dashboard. I don't understand how this is going to work, but you seem like a kid. You like, you know, you like all the same bands as me. Sure, let's do it, whatever. And we did it, and it obviously turned out to be one of the biggest decisions I've ever made. And he then went on to form The Academy Is, and I was pissed. I was furious when he did that, because to me, I was like, dude, we have so much momentum with Remember Maine. I mean, we sold probably like 2,000 records of Remember Maine, and at the time that was crazy. That was huge. Like, we had never sold through a 1,000 CD pressing prior to Remember Maine. So that was huge, and I was pissed that he was like, "Well, I'm going to do another band." I'm like, "Why are you going to do another band? We're doing so well. We're touring. We're getting, you know, in certain stores, and people are helping." And he's like, "Just come to one of our practices." And I was like, "Okay." So took me and the other guy who I owned the label with, we went to a practice. They had two songs, the Academy at the time. And they played the two songs twice in a row. And I remember literally leaving there with them. We went to get pizza somewhere and we were like, all right, this is going to be
all good.
This is going to be the thing. This is way better than Remember Maine. People are going to, you know, because we would go on tour with Remember Maine. We'd play. It would just be me and him in a minivan. We'd go to the East Coast, and he would literally get ridiculed at every show. Like, we would play hardcore shows. We would just take any show we can get. We played in a barn. We played in a basement. Somewhere in Massachusetts, I remember, it was like a hardcore fest. It was like 12 hardcore bands and him. And he was in the middle because he was doing well, so people wanted to see him. So there was like a row of like 10 kids singing along, loving it. Other than that, people were just literally screaming at him. Like, and I remember he's like, that was a rough show. And he comes back to the merch. I'm like, pack up, we got to go. He's like, what do you mean? I was like, those three dudes over there were literally talking shit the whole time. I think we're going to get jumped. And he's like, what? And it was like, I'm like, we got to go. We got to go.
Why?
So it was just crazy. It was just like, they just hated it and were just like emo faggot, like crazy, like obscenities at him. And we're like literally talking about kicking his ass. Like, and I'm, you know, I'm 18, he's like 16. And I'm like, we got to go. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's just us here. There's a whole crowd. Like, let's just run. So we did. And we left. And I remember that point. It always stuck out to me. I was like, man, he has such a tough time with this project that, like, I hate that he has to even deal with shit like this. And then when he showed me the band, like, selfishly, I'm like, you know what? This is his ticket out of like that whole, like, being ridiculed. And, you know,
yeah,
it's really sad that that was even a thought, but it was like, he's such a good front man that, like, maybe put down the guitar. Maybe this is cool. Like, maybe we try this, you know? So then they did. And
it worked out.
Worked out immensely for all of us involved because it launched a lot of things for all, the whole group that kind of committed to it. So that obviously was a little side note. But, yes, it was August Vermeer and Academy went to Fuel by Ramen. Gatsby's American Dream was another one that I started working with early on that went to Fearless. And then Hidden in Plain View was the other one that went on to Drive Through. So those four, I had 10 releases total, four of them being those. And the track record was just kind of going well. And again, with Fuel by Ramen signing two of the bands, I kind of had a relationship there. And right when Academy signed, is when Fall Out Boy was really blowing up. And that's when John Janik, the owner, flew up and was seeing Academy. So he stayed with us because I lived with the guys at the time. And we just had great conversations about music. And like early on, I was also going to be putting out a Fall Out Boy record. I was just friendly with those guys. And I remember the day Pete called me and was like, yo, you can't put it out anymore. We're putting it out at Fuel by Ramen.
Oh, no.
I was like, well, that's awesome. Because I was always the guy that just wanted my friends to succeed. I didn't care about that stuff. And actually, to a fault, like I had Academy locked up for three records. I put out one and Fuel by Ramen called and were like, we don't do buyouts. We don't spend money like that. So if you want to let them go, we'll sign them. And I remember the look on William and Mike from the guy from Academy's faces, and I just kind of was like, you know what? I'm going to make the dumbest decision I could ever make. I'm going to tear up the contract. You should go sign. And I did.
Oh, man.
I tore it up, and it was all
good. What a nice guy.
It was a decision that at the time, everyone told me I was stupid, everyone in music, and I was just like, you know what? It's the right thing to do. They're my friends. I want them to succeed. And they signed, and a month later, Fuel by Ramen came knocking and tried to hire both me and my partner, Tony. Come to find out that the Academy guys were a huge cheerleading squad for us to go get that. And also Pete was too. He's just like, you got to bring this kid in. He's in touch with all of it. So I think ripping up that contract allowed me to keep the relationship that I have with the guys and got me the job that started my entire career rather than me holding them hostage, probably selling, you know, 5,000-10,000 records and like being an asshole. Not an asshole because I earned the right to have that contract. But I, you know, at the same time, it just the foresight, I guess it would have been short-sighted of me to be like, no, you're putting out the record with me. I don't care what you say. You know, we wouldn't have had any of those opportunities. It would just been a tough thing. So luckily I was in a sense raised right to treat my friends and family a certain way where I was like, you know what? Good luck. I'm stoked for you guys. And in turn got me the job at Fuel by Ramen during the time of the explosion. So it kind of worked out.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely good timing. Did you get to work on the Fall Out Boy record and the Academy record once you got into FBR, or was this still at the point when you're in retail?
I did get to work on them somewhat. So my first record, when I did get hired to work at retail, was actually Academy is Almost Here. So the timing was pretty awesome on that. And I instantly became the retail guy for Take This to Your Grave, and From Under the Cork Tree was coming out like 6 months later. So I got to help Island with that a little bit to connect the dots, because we stayed involved with them through, I think through Cork Tree was really the hands-on stuff. And then it went so big after Sugar were going down that it was like, all right, this is a major label band now. You can sell a shirt in your web store, have fun, you know? I worked with those guys hand in hand, both bands, and it was awesome just cause I had known them for years and helped kind of launch a little bit of each of them in different respects. But just even to this day, I still speak to all of them, and we don't work directly on anything, but there are times that it is like, I mean, we debuted a Water Park single at Equal Vision on Pete's stereo show last week. So it's like, there's still like friendliness that goes on where it's like, oh, you have this thing, I have this thing. How do we do cool shit together still? So it works out.
That's awesome, man. That's so cool. You know, these are things I only knew about fairly recently, which is interesting. I've been following you on, you know, I kind of knew like, Johnny Minardi, he was with FBR. Like, I don't really know what it is you did. So apart from you know, those early years doing retail, at some point you got to move up and do a little A&R for the label itself. So why don't you tell me about that? Where did that begin and what were some of the highlights of that time?
Awesome. Yeah, it was, you know, again, with LLR being a thing, I had just always found bands and did the thing of, oh, I think I found this, I'll show my boss. You know what I mean? Like, there was a couple bands that I brought to him, one being the Hush Sound, one being other stuff. And some of it he signed, some of it he didn't sign. And then there was one when it was Forgive Durden was the first thing I got to bring in and fully work myself as an A&R. I had brought it in again through Gatsby's American Dream, who I was still friendly with while they were on Fearless. And he was just like, you got to meet this kid, Thomas. He's got such grand ideas and, you know, he's just real crafty and his songs are great. Like, you should talk to him. So I did. Brought it to my boss, and I think the idea for Wonderland was already all thought through from Thomas, and he pitched it as that, like as a full, this is my first release that I want on a label. And I think he sent me a VHS tape of them playing live in like Denver or something terrible. Cause we couldn't, we didn't even like spend the money to go out and see him live. So he's just like, I'll send you a VHS tape. So we did that and I brought the whole package to my boss, and he's such a grand like schemer with like marketing, and he just loves big, lofty, cool things that weren't just, oh, sign a band, put it out, see how it does. Like, that wasn't the style. It was always, what's the story? What's the thing that connects? Like, what can we do that's different than every label? So when I brought him Thomas's idea for Wonderland, he was like, that's incredible. Like, concept records are a little silly to me because they're usually like they don't connect right or something. But I think we had two demos or something at the time. And he was like, the songs are great. The story's great. The vision for artwork's great. Like, there's so many opportunities to make like little animated shorts and like all these cool things. So we saw this as this big thing. And I think we made the record for like $3,000 with Casey Bates or something absurd.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was kind of the thing where he almost was like throwing me a bone of like, all right, let's try something super cheap and let's see what we could dig up here. Which the record broke even and it did well. It didn't do as well as obviously we had all hoped for. But they were getting killer tours. They were out with like Say Anything. They were out with Seosin. Like at the time, like, you know, 800 to 1,000 seater rooms being packed, and they were opening or playing Second of Four, whatever it was. And it was awesome. It was so fun to watch and help Forgive Durden out. And then he brought in Razia's Shadow, which was a whole nother beast of
of a project. One of my all time favorites.
Awesome. I'm glad. And it that again was such a, I think we did it for like $6,000, which makes no sense.
Wow. That doesn't make any sense.
No. So and it was all like favors, or like, I remember he flew to Chicago. Thomas flew to Chicago with a backpack full of recording gear. And we went to a Panic at the Disco show and he recorded Brendan's vocals in the backstage room at Congress Theater in Chicago. And we literally just hung a microphone over some water pipe. And Brendan just did his vocals in like 12 minutes and was like, cool, you got it? You got everything you need? All right, I'm going to hit the stage, you know? And it was like, holy shit. And that's Brendan's whole part on the record. And it's like that.
That's
literally
amazing.
Bootstrapped the whole record and the whole concept. And it was just one of those records that was so cool. And that's all Thomas. Like, that's all. I mean, he convinced everyone, like Casey and everyone else, to be a part of it. But man, it was all his idea and he nailed it. And I was just kind of the guy that would connect dots or beg people for favors to be on the record or whatever. So yeah, that was another one that was like cheap, but amazing product. Like, no one would know that we did it that way because the project was so grand. And I think people that love it, they just love it. You know, it's like beyond anything that they've ever been a part of. So
It's so different. You know, I think Forgive Durden, in at least our racket, is sort of like, you know, the Coheed of a racket not too far from ours. You know, they do that concept thing and they make great music, but they push it and they make it this huge thing. It's like a huge project.
Sure.
Like Forgive Durden, it had the whole story and like, you know, the artwork played into it. And like it was essentially a play. It was a drama. And I loved that. I was a huge nut for that in high school.
Cool. No, that's awesome. Yeah. I mean, even Thomas and his girlfriend Lonnie moved to New York to make it an actual Broadway performance, which they did for a little while. I forget how long it was running, but yeah, they did it. They did a couple shows at least, which was cool. So, but yeah, there was those, it was those records, and that's kind of how I transitioned into it. And then right after that, I had found this Providence, and I signed a band called Power Space from Chicago that we had a bunch of mutual friends. Then I brought in the Swellers, and I brought in Friday Night Boys was kind of a thing that I did with the, with John. But yeah, so I mean, I did a lot of those, but I was still involved in like some of the Academy aspects of it. And then I'd get other records, like I didn't sign Burst or Emerge, but I was making a record with them. And then I brought in A Rocket to the Moon, which was my most successful on the label. So it was a fun time, man. Once I transitioned into A&R, it was the perfect timing because we had just kind of done the sub-labels slash like however you want to call it with Atlantic Records, and they had a full retail staff. So it was almost like I was not needed in that aspect anymore. So luckily I had already had the experience in the A&R stuff and had John's trust. And so many times we were trying to sign the same bands like earlier, like prior to me being there. And then once we were there, we were always listening and finding similar bands and showing each other and being like, oh yeah, we should do that, you know? So we were just kind of in sync with the mindset of the sounds and the certain stories that bands had as they would come in and different things like that.
Right. So at this point, what does the A&R job entail? You know, how do you go about finding these bands?
At that point, it was very word of mouth. The internet stuff wasn't as prevalent yet because you had sites like Absolute Punk that were doing well and a couple other things, but we would be, you know, we would hear about stuff from booking agents that booked our bands, or our bands and whatnot would be on the road. So they'd be like, hey, I'm in Tallahassee, you've got to hear this band that just opened for us. That kind of thing was very big. And then we would kind of weed it out and find the right ones that we thought were great. You know, and we were lucky enough to work with Pete at the time, Pete Wentz in Fall Out Boy, because he had such an ear for, you know, different stuff to where with the Decadence, I mean, we're the Decadence staff too. So he would bring things in and be like, yo, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And he always had a creative angle on it. And obviously he had a way to streamline things of being like, oh, well, I'll just take them on tour. Like it was pretty, he was batting such a crazy batting average for the A&R slot. Cause he'd be like, oh, here's this band and they're amazing. And I'm going to put them in the studio and then I'm going to take them on tour and play to 2,000 people a night. So it would be a pretty awesome ride to sign a band with him. Like Hushdown was one that him and I were both kind of back and forth on, oh, okay, you found this, but I found it. Let me put it on Decadence and you just help make the records and stuff, you know? So there was always a good system between the three of us, between me, him, and John, the owner. At the time too, when I first got there, Vinny from Less Than Jake was still a big part of it. So he would bring in a band or two. And he kind of took a little bit more of a backseat role as the pop side of the label was really going crazy.
Right.
But he kind of stopped signing or stopped being as excited. And you could kind of tell there was a divide happening, which, you know, that just wasn't his thing. He's just more of the DIY guy. And there would be times that we would be like trying to sign a band and he'd be like, I don't like that band. Or he would bring bands that we didn't like or whatever it may be. And it was just like, you could tell the vision for the label was kind of getting pulled in two directions. And we were just like waiting for our parents to decide what we're supposed to do, you know? So it was very interesting, but all, you know, he's still a great guy. I see him every time he comes through Chicago. I mean, Less Than Jake growing up, that was the first punk show I'd ever been to. So I owe him so much.
Oh, cool.
So it was kind of like, almost like I was starstruck when I first met him and worked for him, which was very funny. So, yeah, I mean, the A&R process was kind of what you'd imagine it. I mean, we would be online and searching through forums and getting sent stuff. And, I mean, Pete found Panic at the Disco on a Fall Out Boy message board, which was such a gigantic thing at the time. Like, people were going to the Fall Out Boy message board, and he had, like, a demo section. And we would literally clean through it. And there was a lot of cool shit on there and a lot of people.
It's a great idea.
Yeah. And we just had these things. And back, I think we had some sort of like Feel Bar Ramen demo submission board too, where, you know, you didn't find a ton of stuff in there. You'd run of the gamut, different like terrible stuff, or like people definitely didn't listen to the label because there would be like country folk stuff or like weird stuff. Then you find stuff that would be like influenced by, you know, Fall Out Boy or whatever it was. And you obviously listened to that. And you spent time listening to a couple songs and you were combing through Pure Volume charts. I think mp3.com was done by then. But I think Pure Volume and MySpace and all these, you'd go to a band that you liked and you'd look at their top eight, you know, or, oh, so-and-so's touring with, they're opening the Midwest region of the Say Anything tour. Like, and you'd find those bands and it was a lot of combing through stuff. And we didn't sign a whole lot of bands, I guess. We probably signed a couple a year. But yeah, I mean, it was kind of the process that I still go through now. And I think that it's an interesting thing now with all these different, like, charts, and some sites are going away, but there's still message boards. And now I think being in music for the last 15 years, I have luckily such a killer network of people, whether it be booking agents or managers or, you know, anything, that is like, they'll send me bands. Like, I get probably 10 bands a day that's like, you should check this out. They just opened for us in San Diego, you know, and it's just,
yeah,
cool. Okay, cool. I'll check it out. And sometimes that turns into a deal and it's pretty serendipitous when it does happen, but there's no right or wrong way to do it, I guess you could say.
So how much would you say has changed since you started? I mean, it kind of sounds like it's more or less the same thing. Maybe the internet makes some of it a little easier as far as like contacting people, but it still sounds very much like a word of mouth, like, hey, these guys are great, you should check them out sort of deal.
Yep. No, absolutely. It's still the core is still very similar. I guess it's dressed up in different ways. The one issue I will say that is a lot different than it used to be is there's so many labels and bands that want deals so fast that they sign these long-term deals when they're like super young and super small.
Yeah.
To where, like, if I find out about a band, they've got a 3-record deal with Animal Style Record or something. You know what I mean? And it's like, oh, damn. And not everyone's as courteous as me to rip up contracts, I guess. No, it's tough because there's the competition, I feel like, is the playing field is a lot more even with the internet, I will say, for a kid in his bedroom to find a band, which I guess that was me back in the day. But at the same time, it's like, I want to hear and I want to see and I want to meet people. I don't want to just sign a band off of getting an email with one song in it, you know? So I feel like the competition is a lot stiffer now because there's a lot of labels willing to do deals at such an early stage before a band actually comes into their own, you know? And it's tough because I always like to kind of see where a band goes. And a lot of bands hit this wall where it gets tough, where a member leaves or two members leave or something, and then they break up, you know? So it's like, I always like to really learn and get comfortable with the band as people before I, you know, offer a deal to where I'm going to be their guy for the next 6 to 7 years, ideally, you know?
So how much time are you spending with these bands before you give them a contract?
It's different with every one of them, but I mean, there's a band that I had just finished signing where I talked to them a bunch on the phone and I went to see them when they came through Chicago, took them out to dinner, watched their show, and then kind of just stayed in touch, and they sent me demos for their next round, and they said, I think it was 4 songs, and 2 of them were just like incredible, and I was like, yep, your last record was great, these 2 songs show me that it wasn't a random thing, like, in your vision for what you told me when we met. Like, I kind of did that process and felt great about it, you know what I mean? Like, I just was like, I know those people, like, I can call them right now. There's a band called Sleep On It from Chicago that I signed a couple months ago, and their record comes out on the 21st of this month that we've been working for an EP. And I have known those guys personally for 2 years, and I have been watching them and advising them, honestly. And I was kind of helping them get their feet under them. And they took every piece of advice I have given for 2 years and like went above and beyond it. And they would always check in. I'd go to shows, just be friendly at other, I mean, we'd go see other shows together and stuff, and they'd update me on their band. And then when it all clicked and they sent me songs that I thought were finally great, and they just changed singers too, which I was a fan of Zach, the new singer, when he was in Bonfires. So I just built relationships with them. And then it came time where they showed me new music, and I was just like, I'm in. And they're like, okay, let's do this. You know what I mean? But it's like,
nice.
That took 2 years of being friends, and like, they weren't ready 2 years ago. And I gave them a ton of advice, and no one has to take my advice. It's all in my opinion. And I've been wrong, mm-hmm. been wrong many times.
But you've also been around for a long time.
Yeah.
You've seen stuff.
Yeah. And I think,
you know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think they trusted that, and they grew up during the Chicago scene that I was helping try to build. So they were always very much looking up to me, and I didn't take that lightly. And I gave them advice that I like, tactical things that I would do like right now. I was like, even though I don't think your music is as good as it's going to get, this is what you could do to get fans to be around for when you do hit that pinnacle of writing the best music of your career. Then fans will be there and excited and watched you have worked for this, and it won't be this random band coming out of nowhere. And they did all of it. And like I said, that's a band I'm crazy excited about being a part of, because it's one that I've sort of been working with, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like I've helped shape what they've done, but they went well above and beyond that, like I said. And I can't wait to put that record out and put out a full length next year and get that band out on the road, because I think it's going to be killer.
And this is coming out on Equal Vision?
Yes, it is. Equal Vision, October 21st, Sleep On It EP.
Awesome. I'll have links to that in the show notes. Awesome. So you joined Equal Vision sometime last year. Was that about summertime?
Yes, in May of last year. So I had been friendly with them throughout my entire time at Feel Bar Ramen. And then when I managed, I started managing producers when I stopped at Feel Bar Ramen. So some of my producers would do records for them, and it was just always very cordial. And I managed William Beckett during his solo career, and I signed him to Equal Vision. And I had always just loved the label. I mean, I grew up on a million of those bands myself. So when I was managing William and we signed the deal there, it was just a pleasure to work with, and I loved the label. And I was kind of very torn on ever going back to a label, just because I didn't know if I wanted someone else's vision to be my thing. Because I just kind of was like, all right, I've done that. That's fun. I got that experience. That's great. So I actually randomly one day turned to my wife and told her, I am going to start a label tomorrow. I'm going to call Equal Vision to see if they're interested in having it be a sub-label. And she's like, are you crazy? What are you talking about? And I was like, I don't know. I just got this feeling like I got to create something and be a part of something big. I'm going to do it. I'm just going to start a label. I'm going to call Dan from Equal Vision tomorrow and see what he says. So I call him and I spill that. And he literally is just like, well, that's a lot to take in. I didn't have any clue that you had any interest in that. I was like, yeah. He's like, all right, give me some time. And I was like, all right, cool. So he calls me back a week later and says, well, I'm going to say no to the label. And I was like, shit. I was like, I didn't really think that through well, huh? And he's like, yeah, I don't know where that came from. But what I will say is we like a lot of the same bands. It was the same conversation that I had 10 years prior at Feel Bar Ramen. We like a lot of the same bands. I could use your help. We're expanding. I feel like it just makes sense to just come sign bands with me. We have sub-labels. Mm. Like, I feel like, come help me continue building the Equal Vision brand. And I was like, well, shit, I didn't even think of that. Okay, let's talk about that. So we talked about it a little bit, and then a few weeks later was South by Southwest, 2015, so a year and a half ago. And we met, we had dinner, me, him, and Francesca, who's the other A&R at the label. And we just talked about where the label was at, like where it's going, what bands are excited about, what the vision was for the future and all that. And I was kind of like, I mean, you're speaking my language. I love this. And they're like, all right, well, you're having a kid in a month. When you have your kid, take a couple weeks off. That's important. Spend time with your family. Do that thing. And the day you're ready to start working, you'll start working. And I was like, holy shit. Okay. So I work for you now. This is cool. So, nice. Yeah, it literally came from a random whim that I wanted to start a label and just threw it at him, and he was stoked, and that was it.
That's awesome, dude. A year later at South by Southwest, I got to meet you in person for the first time, and
that's right.
I also went and saw a band called Owl twice that week.
Sure.
And when I was talking to them after their set on the rooftop, I was like, hey, you know, like, what's going on? When's this new record coming out? They're like, well, we're talking to some labels. We're actually talking to some A&R guy down here. And my mind immediately jumped to no other person than you. Of course, like, Equal Vision has always made sense for them. So when I heard that they're talking to AR, I'm like, I wonder if that's Minority. So of course, the next morning when they're playing their early set, you're there. And I'm like, I knew it. I knew it. Yeah. And then sure enough, yeah. about like a month or so ago, you announced the signing yeah. and a new record coming out. So that's yeah. that's awesome, man. Yeah. I'm stoked for that.
That they have been the perfect band for the label forever. And that one actually came in through Dan, and he was just like, this band is literally incredible. You have to hear these songs. And I was like, and mm-hmm. I think it was a couple weeks prior to South By. So I was like, all right, cool. And he's like, and they're playing South By like six fucking times. So you better go see them. I was like, I'll see him. I'll meet him. I'll do all of this. And I think at that time it was being wrapped up outside of that, but he's like, just, you know, go have the conversations and meet him. And, you know,
yeah.
And we did
now,
that.
Is this Dan Martyr?
Dan Sandshaw.
Oh, okay. I gotcha.
Dan Sandshaw has been at Equal Vision for now like 18 years or something insane.
Okay.
He's 300 records he's put out with Equal Vision, which is amazing. Yeah, he just was basically like, go see him. And I think I was texting him throughout the entire set, like, wherever the contract's at, hurry up and finish it, because this is insane. Like, this band is, like, moving. There's just this cool thing. And obviously, you know that. You saw them twice. But it's just – and the record is incredible. It comes out in a couple – in I think a month now, in early November. So, yeah, I mean, it's that one was perfect for the label. That the sound and everything. Everything with them and manager and agent are friendly with us, and that's how it all came mm-hmm. through. So great band, though.
They're insanely talented. Very, very, you like you say, they're moving. Like,
yeah, there's something about it that can't be. I think I brought a person or two to that show, and they're like, what's this band? I'm like, just come see it. Like, it's all good. And I think walking out of it, that they were feeling that same way. Like, what was that? That was just fucking awesome. I was like, I know. It's hard to explain. It's just very cool.
Yeah. Like 4 or 5 years ago, Dan Martyr from In the Clouds Records, he asked me and my friend Keegan to do some, you know, publicity for his label. And I, you know, I was aware of the label. I knew they did cool stuff. But what he really sold me on was Owl. He showed me that band. And then he sent me a copy of the vinyl record that they had produced for that, which had like, you know, like an active piano inside of it, which was really fucking rad.
Crazy.
And I was like, I'm in. Let's, you know, let's do it. And from that point on, I've been the biggest fan, and I'm super stoked for this new record.
Yeah, awesome. I'm glad to hear that.
So you've done quite a lot of stuff, man. You've done a lot of A&R. We've talked a lot about your A&R. I think you could probably go all day with stories, and I'm sure anybody listening to this who didn't have the chance to send me any questions for you is going to be like really bummed that I didn't ask you about their favorite Fuel by Ramen band. But you've got some other stuff going on right now, so I want to talk to you about Self-Titled Management. Tell me about that.
Sure. Yeah. So when I stopped working at Fuel by Ramen in 2014, I think it was. 2012. Yeah, 2006 to 2012. It was 8 years to the day. And just during my time there, and prior even at Little League Records, whenever I would be doing a record from the label side, I always felt like communication was tough for producers because they're in the studio 12 hours a day. Sometimes they had managers, sometimes they didn't. I didn't understand why some didn't. Again, naive of me, but I just kind of was like, well, it makes so much sense. Why don't they have someone helping handle all of the logistics of it? So when I stopped working at Fuel by Ramen, I think within a couple days, I had already been like, I know what I want to do next. I had already been kind of managing William and helping. So I was like, I don't know if I love artist management, but there's something about producer management that I just feel like is on the level of what I want to do. Being a role reversal from the A&R side, I was already kind of putting records together on the A&R side and budgeting and scheduling and doing all that, the creative stuff. So I kind of was like, why don't I just call all the producers I used to work with at Fuel by Ramen and just ask them why they never had a manager, you know, kind of dig a little bit. And every person I asked by the end of that phone call was like, well, shit, I never had a good one. You want to do it? And I was like, yeah. So like within the first week, I was managing guys that I had made records with. I mean, Casey was one that I made the Forgive Durden records with in this Providence. Right. Mark McCluskey made the Power Space record for me. Rob Freeman was in Hidden in Plain Views, and he made part of a Gym Class record for us. So like it was all these records and guys that I loved just as friends, and I was like, you're a killer producer, why don't I be the guy that goes and gets you jobs and organizes your life, and then you could focus on the studio. So that's how it started, and then it grew into I think 14 guys right now. I think I work with some full time and some are kind of part time guys that are, you know, touring musicians and stuff, like Arun from Saves the Day. And, you know, so there's guys that I work with and handle their calendar and schedule jobs and negotiate their deals and make sure everything is beautiful on the business side of it all. But yeah, so that's how it started, kind of out of necessity and curiosity. And I just was like, well, I need to figure out a next step for me. And I just feel like this is a cool way to do it. I've kept these friends for so long, and now that I have a network of labels and managers, like, why don't I be the guy that connects the dots for you, you know? So
that's smart.
Yeah, and it just worked, and I just have fun with it. And a lot of the guys are friends first before clients, and I've known them and made records with them. And it's just one of those things where it's like, I want to make sure they're taken care of, you know? And there's a lot of shiesty things that go on in the industry that I'm like, well, if I'm the guy handling your books and making sure you're taken care of, then I'll feel a lot better about it because you're a friend. So
right.
Let me just do that for you. So it kind of just did that and snowballed into what it is now with a bigger roster. And I love it. I mean, it's one of my favorite things that I get to do and converse. And there's nothing better than going after a record together, getting it, and then having it come out and sell a shitload. And it's like very rewarding in that sense of it too, that I'm helping those people.
And you're still based in Chicago, right? Are you doing all this from home?
I am. I've been working from home now, since 2006. So 10 years now.
Wow.
From home in Chicago. I'm moving to Orange County in 3 weeks, though. And Yeah. So I'm moving to Southern California, which will be opening an Equal Vision office out there because Francesca from the label's out there. And we have another, our social media guy, right. Andrew's from, he's in San Diego right now, but we'll be moving up. So we will be getting an office in LA somewhere in the next couple months, hopefully, because I'll be out there in 3 weeks, like I said. So, making the
jump.
That's
crazy, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. You know, up to this point, though, how do you maintain that work-life balance? I think a lot of people that listen to the show work from home or, you know, do their side projects and stuff from home, and they have a hard time separating the home from the work. So how have you been able to sort of separate that for yourself?
A lot of practice, I guess, because at first I was not good at it. I will be honest. I moved from working in an office at Field Bar Ramen in Tampa for, I think it was 2.5 years. I lived and worked there every day. And they, when they relocated to New York, I didn't want to go to New York. So I was like, well, I want to go back to Chicago. I'll travel whenever you need me anywhere. It's no big deal. I'm just not in the office. And at first it was a big deal because it was like, the freedom was dangerous because it was like, I would wake up whenever I would do my work. And if no one was hitting me up or if I didn't have a record to work, like there was nothing huge on my plate, I could do whatever I wanted. And I kind of took advantage of it and like things suffered for me for sure. And I would get hit up all the time by my boss and he's like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, where are you? Like everyone's saying they can't get a hold of you. And I was just like, you know, it was like, I'm saying this, but it was like a month or two of that. You know what I mean? Like, and it was just a lot to it. Cause I just would sit down and start working. And then it's like, the TV, you know, watch this, watch that, go do this. Like I literally took advantage of it in a way to where I was just lazy about it. And then, you know, I kind of like got, you know, re-inspired and motivated when certain bands were putting out records to where I didn't have time to do that anymore. And I actually like was much happier that way. And I was not lazy. And I think the thing is you just got to set your own like accomplishments, I guess, is what you want to accomplish and your goals. Now, I mean, I work silly hours. I mean, I'm up at 6:30 getting the kid off to school with the wife. And then I'm working probably like 14, 15 hours doing all the different things I do. And I wouldn't have it any other way. I love it. Like to think back on the time when I had free time and I didn't take advantage of it, I'm so mad at myself for not like taking advantage of the time frame that I was like at Field Bar Ramen and doing that, you know, early on.
Right.
Whereas now it's like, I don't know what free time really is anymore. And that sounds, sounds like kind of lame to say, but it's like between a family and between doing this, between Equal Vision, self-titled, and I also run a thing called Noise Creators. It's like, there's so much to do that like, my to-do list is sitting right in front of me right now. I have three different to-do lists that when we wrap up, that it's like, I'll go right back to it. And then whatever the day throws at me on top of that just has to be done, you know? So it's just, I think it's finding your own balance. And it took me, in a sense, hitting rock bottom of like being lazy And a little bit of getting scolded at work too, of like, you're fucking up. Like, you told me it was
right. That scary phone call from your boss. Like,
absolutely.
Hey, you're on thin ice.
Yeah. It's like, I let you do this. I trusted you and you promised me it'd be this way. And it's not that way. What's going on?
Yeah.
How has this changed? And I'm like, you got it. From that day forward, I don't think he ever questioned it again. Cause it was just like overdoing it and over communicating. You have to learn to communicate but differently. Like, I can't just walk down the office and tell someone I did something and now it's up to them to carry it the rest of the way. It's me doing things and assuming that they knew that, and then it'd fall through the cracks and it'd be like, well, dude, how would I know you finished? I didn't know that. And it's like, oh fuck, you're right. I have to update people. Like, and I was probably annoying for a little while trying to find the right groove and the right amount of, you know, what do I tell them? What do I not tell them? So, it's, you got to find it on your own. And I guess for me at the time, I didn't have it in me and I suffered from it. And then once I turned it around, like I said, that since that like phone call, I was like, what am I doing? Like, I'm working at one of the biggest labels. I'm about to fuck it up. Like, I'm like growing a career, but you're really not. You're just treading water and like phoning it in. Like, do shit. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So, and then it, you know, like I said, it clicked for me. So the advice I'd give is just to kind of like find it and know that other people, you know, one thing I learned from my boss at the time is like, everyone says that they work hard, but not everyone works hard. Like, how hard is hard work for certain people? You know, like, that's one advantage that you can always have over someone, and there's no excuse of expensive, there's no excuse of anything. Just do your shit, you know, like, and find a way to make it happen and put in more hours if you have to, unless you get better at it or hire people or whatever. So I think once that clicks, it starts to be like, well, I can't afford to hire someone, so I have to do two jobs. Okay, got it. Do two jobs.
Yeah, that's good advice. Work harder.
I wish
you mentioned Noise Creators there.
Yep.
Tell me about Noise Creators. That's a really cool project.
Cool. I'm glad you agree. It's something that, again, like, I was doing the producer manager stuff, and there was never really a place when I was at labels to go and kind of research producers, except for like if they had a Wikipedia page or if they had a website that was well maintained, which most aren't. And then the credit sites, there's All Music, album credits, there's all these different sites, but they're never fully up to date or 100% accurate. And they're hard when they're inaccurate to get it to be accurate. They just don't follow through on changing credits if they're incorrect. So there was just no place I felt like, especially coming from this scene in our world, that you could find, you know, guys like James Baldwin that did monumental records and, no one knew, you know what I mean? Like, no one knows that he launched Under Oath and Academy as in Paramore and Dashboard. Like, there's so many records that his name's attached to that people just don't get it. And I'm like, I feel like that's such a disservice. And being from the producer manager side of things, obviously I selfishly wanted to put those guys on pedestals and be like, my guys have such killer credits. I wonder, how do I connect that dot from the average music listener, the average band member or whatever? So I kind of thought up this idea, and it was in process for about a year and a half, and I couldn't find the right partners to build the site for me. And I just wanted it to be a site to where any band or label or even fan of music can find it interesting to go to the site. We feature producers. We have all of their credits that are searchable by band, label, location. Like, you could find anything you wanted to get a good producer in this world. And there's a ton of options. I think we're at like 90 producers on the site. And we do podcasts with anyone who wants to do podcasts. We do interviews, we do features on, if they're putting out new music that they produced from whatever band on whatever label, we feature that like every 2 weeks. We round it up and put it all out there. So just basically creating a pedestal for the producers to get a spotlight on them, because there just isn't that thing. So kind of want to connect the dot, I find that, honestly, we get a lot of feedback from music fans that are never going to pay the producer for a service, that listen to a podcast and they find it so interesting and they go back to those records and tell us like, oh, you told me that you did this on that song and I went back and listened and it's so rad to hear the story behind it, or how you got him to sing like this and he had to cut it 20 different times before you got the right emotion out of him in that song. And it's like, it's just very shit that I would want to know about my favorite records, I guess. So selfishly, I built it that way.
That's awesome, dude. It's a great resource. I mean, I used it to prepare a little bit for this episode. I've used it to prepare for episodes past. So it's awesome to have all that information there. And like you said, you know, credit sites suck.
Yeah.
Like Discogs is great. AllMusic is great. There's a lot of resources that have like bits and pieces, but when you get people with names that are, you know, duplicates of other people's names, like right. those credits get mixed up and you're like, what? He worked on that country record? No way.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know, having a place that like has the, excuse me, having the place that's, you know, has like the canonical timeline
sure.
of somebody's work is super valuable.
Yeah. And we kind of like worked hand in hand with every producer on the site. So those credits that they're delivering those and they're upping those to us and we update them for them manually, but they're in charge of that. So that's what's important to me is it's like it's kind of breaking down that wall that like producers are this big bad scary thing that you can't even reach out to. And a lot of the things too is like a lot of bands feedback, and we have a thing on the site that I think is the most important tool as it grows and we educate more people about it, is like people can come to us and say, hey, I'm a band in Jersey, I want to record an EP, we have this amount of money, who should we work with? And literally put it into the experience of myself and my partner, Jesse Cannon, and say, oh, here's five different guys that are in Jersey, and here's five guys that are like in the Midwest and further if you're willing to travel. But here's the different costs that each guy would charge per song kind of thing. We know some schedules of some guys. And it's like we try to help connect that band to these producers. And sometimes producers have these wide open gaping holes in their calendar where they're like, I have nothing for November. So we could go and we have this pool of bands that are like looking for what's the right fit. What's the right fit? Here's our timeline. And then we put them together and it's like the producer's stoked because they're making money and filling calendar. The band's stoked because they're working with this producer that produced some of their favorite records, but they thought it'd be $5,000 a song, so they never reached out, or they didn't know how to reach out because some guys don't have websites. So how do you reach out to them, you know?
Right.
So it's just kind of like pulling all of the what ifs out of the equation and being like, we get emails all the time from bands. Some of them are outrageous and like, we have $1,000 to record a full length record. Can we work with Will Putney? And it's like, no, but here's someone that would charge you $350 a song that's in New York that has similar credits. And we try to like kind of like help with our knowledge and their budgets and what they're looking for to be like, here's a guy that makes more sense for you for this record because your budget is only X amount, you know? And it's about pairing that together that I think is important. And it's not about like, oh, these guys are money hungry. It's like they just want to, some of the producers just want to work with cool bands and they don't have time to research bands and they don't know where to find them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Time.
So this is just a tool to where it's like, I love when bands reach out and they almost give me no info and they're like, here's what we sound like. We're trying to do a record. What would you recommend? And they don't even say a budget or a time frame or anything. And I just come back with like three guys. I'm like, these are killer. Here's what they charge. You interested? And they literally come back 9 out of 10 times. They're like, yes, even if it's not instant, it's like, cool, next summer we're going to come back and work with so-and-so who did this record because we love that and we listen to his podcast, and the way he talks about working records is so intriguing to us, and it sounds like he actually gives a shit. And it's like, well, he does actually give a shit. We've made records with him. Everyone on the site is a personal connection. We've had people on the site that we've kicked off because of bad practice. We instantly vet that because it's not worth whatever commission it is. It's not worth the bad reputation. So it's very important to us that people know that we're doing it to try to connect, like to make good music still really at the core of it.
Amazing, amazing service. Really cool. So if you're in a band, check this out. It's really great. If you're a producer, check this out. Get your info on there. You know, get connected. I think it's a really awesome resource. I'm glad to see it thrive. It seems to be thriving. I'm seeing the name more and more. Cool. So it's cool to see it's growing.
Appreciate it. Yeah, it is definitely growing. It's been, I think it's been a year now and it's been growing. So it's been awesome.
That's awesome, dude. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. So before we end this thing out, I want to get some recommendations from you. Feel free to toss in, you know, things you're working on, but I really want to know what it is you're into right now.
Cool. I obviously spoke about the Sleep On It EP that comes out October 21st. We spoke about Oil. The record comes out, I think, November 11th, I want to say. Yeah. So that record's coming out soon. And if you're a fan of any pop punk from the last 10 years, 15 years, the Waterpark record is mind-blowingly, like, to me, like, I didn't know what to expect from it after the EP and knowing the guys, and they turned in the record, and I freaked out. I was like, this is probably the best like pop side of the pop rock that I've heard in so long. So have you heard that record? I feel like you've heard a couple songs.
Yes, I've heard a couple songs. I've not heard the whole record.
Yeah.
Dang, those songs are good.
Crazy stuff, crazy stuff. There's a couple other things. Nothing Nowhere is an awesome new thing that I love, and it's just I just saw them like a month ago, and I can't stop listening. So
I recommended them on the last episode of the show.
Awesome. Well, that's
really cool. Interesting.
Definitely check it out if you didn't on the last one. Band called Capstan from Florida is awesome. They're unsigned. They're very cool. I'm hoping to see them at some point. Band called Household is dope. Killer stuff, kind of like Story So Far meets Being as an Ocean kind of thing. Band called Backwards Dancer I love. It's kind of like a Nirvana meets Brand New thing, which I know is the craziest thing to say ever in this world, but something about that band. They got an EP up right now, I think, for free download. Go listen to that. But yeah, that's kind of where my musical tastes have been lately. Obviously a lot of Equal Vision stuff, but that's the stuff I bring in and work with, so I live on it. So
right, I expect that from you. Yeah. I mean, I think that makes sense.
Cool. What about
personally?
You?
I've been listening to this new podcast called The Heavyweight Podcast. It's from Gimlet Media. Cool. If you're a fan of any of the Gimlet shows, or you know, like Mystery Show, which was recently canceled, yeah. Heavyweight is really, really good. It's about this dude who essentially just goes out and kind of like brings people to bear on, you know, these uncomfortable moments in their life, which is kind of cool. It's an investigative kind of show. So, you know, it's super, it's light. It's only like 30 or 40 minutes each time. And it's really moving kind of stuff sometimes. So it's a good show. Otherwise, Anderson .Paak has a whole bunch of new singles out. He's got an NX Worries song out. I've been listening through a bunch of the new like Apple Music playlists, like My Favorite Mix, like you know, the what do they call it? It's like the For You mix,
right.
And they put out like a new music mix every single week. That's really cool. So I'm using that to find new stuff. I'm taking advantage of that new service. So that's good stuff. Otherwise, you know, this is my third podcast in a week. It's hard to recommend something new every single time.
But yeah,
Nothing Nowhere is really good. Water Parks is really good. We've mentioned that on a couple shows here. And I'm just waiting for that old record.
Yeah.
I want it so bad.
Soon enough, my friend. Very soon.
Yeah, soon.
Cool.
All right, man. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show. I could talk to you all day. There's so many questions I want to ask about things, but I'd like to have you back at some point to, you know, talk shop and talk stories, because I'm sure you have thousands of them.
Well, that'll be fun. I appreciate you having me, and absolutely, let's do a part two at some point, and we'll go through a million stories. They're always fun to recant myself.
All right, well, that's it for this episode of Variable Bitrate. I'd like to thank Johnny again for joining me. You can find the show on Twitter as VBRFM. I'm Jacob Tender, and Johnny is Johnny Minardi. The show notes can be found at curbside.audio/VBR/18 or any podcast player you choose to use. I use Overcast. You can hit the recommend button there. It helps out the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time.